This week we're chatting with new media guru, Don McAllister from the Screencast Online, My Mac Podcast number 176.
The next generation of radio, it's the MyMac.com Podcast.
And I'm Tim Robertson, publisher of MyMac.com, a redesigned MyMac.com. Spent a whole 8 hours changing the look and the design after about 3 years of planning. And so that's now online. So if you want to check that out, check it out at MyMac.com. Of course, we've got Guy Searle from Virginia. Hi, Guy.
Hey, Tim. How's it going today?
More Mac problems, but what's new?
Yeah,
it seems like the last couple weeks it's... I always brag to people, oh, I never have problems with my computer. That's why I use Macs. And then I am trying to record a podcast at the last minute, almost an hour late, because nothing but problems. Go figure.
Well, it could be worse. You could have Windows.
I'll get to that later. But remind me of that, and I'll give you a funny story about that.
Check and check.
From the UK is David Cohen. Hello, David.
Good evening, everyone.
And how is your Macs treating you?
I've just upgraded a hard drive in my MacBook Pro, and now for some reason my VMware won't see my bootcamp partition, so I need to sort that out.
And also from the UK is Don McAllister. Hello, Don.
Hello, Tim. Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
No, thanks for inviting me.
I think we met... Were you at Macworld Expo?
Yes, I was this year,
I believe I met you... At, I don't remember, the Smile On, were you at the Smile On?
Oh, the Smile On Mac party.
Yes.
That's right, in that downstairs room in that.
Yes.
Yes, down by the restaurant. Yeah, that's right.
That's where I met you.
Okay.
I was thinking about that since I invited you on the podcast to chat with us, and I saw your picture online. I thought, I met him somewhere, but I could not pinpoint
it. Right, I know, yes, I remember you now. Yep, I know exactly who you are now. Yeah, that's right. I can picture you perfectly. Yep.
So now you're going to let us go, right? You're out of here.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Come on!
Yeah, see you again.
So you are running one of the coolest Mac, and not just really Mac, but it's a new media type of website, but it really does focus on the Mac, Screencasts Online. Tell us a little bit about Screencasts, when you got started, and why. More importantly, why did you start doing this?
Okay, yeah, well, it's been running now for about 2.5 years, and it's a weekly video podcast, basically. I do a weekly video tutorial and send that out across the web using iTunes and RSS feeds and all that good stuff. I originally started it very much as a hobby podcast. I did actually want to start when I first learned about podcasting, I just thought it was a really great technology and wanted to have a go, so I sort of got a domain name and I got all the website set up, and then I sort of sat down in front of the mic and couldn't think of anything to say, so I thought...
I think a lot of people fall into that category.
Welcome to my world.
But so I sort of left it for a bit, and then I was quite new to the Mac, to be honest, and I'd sort of persuaded a few family members to get into the Mac as well, especially one was my sister-in-law, and she actually lived quite a way away from me, and I really wanted to be able to show her how to do certain things, because obviously she didn't live close to me, and I sort of did a couple of screencasts just to show her some of the basics of the Mac, and sort of one thing led to another, and I thought, you know, it was really useful, and I thought, well, this is just a piece of media, you know, it's a media file. Instead of doing an audio podcast, why don't I... look at distributing this video via a podcast. And at the time, there weren't that many video podcasts out there, to be honest.
Not 2.5 years ago.
No. So I sort of did that, and I did it every week for about 6 months. And the audience figures grew, and one thing led to another. People, you know, were really enthusiastic about the content I was generating and wanted to contribute. And then it just sort of... It's morphed into a full-time job for me now, so it's my full-time gig doing the week.
Now, I have to ask, you know, I do an audio podcast, but I do a lot of writing as well, and I've done some video stuff, but I can't imagine putting a video together once a week.
30 minutes long.
30 minutes long. That's a lot of work. What's your workflow look like? I mean, how do you get that much done that quickly? I mean, a lot of people are thinking, oh, it's only like 30 minutes long. That's not too much. But when you start planning it, recording it, editing, that's a lot of work.
Yeah, it is. And it's the only reason, it's the main reason why I went full time, because I was finding when I was trying to put a video out every week, when I was, I had a day job as well, I was sort of spending, you know, long, long late night hours and most of my weekend trying to get the show out, because it does take best part of 2 to 3 days to do the show. And a lot of that is sort of, doing things on the fly, not really, you know, planning it out properly, but that actually just doing the work, actually doing the production side of things. So I'm fairly fortunate in that I can, I don't know how it happens, but I can sort of, because most of the podcasts are on applications, you know, how to use a particular application in a particular way.
Sure, right.
And, you know, I sort of pick up quite quickly the best way to demonstrate how to use something to somebody. You know, I seem to have a knack of focusing in at the right areas and sort of working out a logical structure on how it should be presented to people. So that bit, you know, it's perhaps, you know, a couple of hours, half a day, sort of thinking about it, using the package, getting into the package and trying really to work out how I'm actually going to present it to people. And then the recording side is actually the shortest part. It probably only takes me 2 to 3 hours to actually record the show, but again, it's lots of sort of.
Does that include the editing down to 2.5 hours?
No. The editing's the main part, really, because it's sort of very much done in very small segments, and obviously you make mistakes or you want to do things slightly differently. So, you know, for every minute of video, I might actually record 5 or 6 minutes worth of bits that either haven't gone as I planned, or, you know, I've made mistakes and have to go back. So at the end of the recording process, I'm left with a couple of hours of video, which I then have to go through and assemble. And that's the real killer. That's the big piece. You know, it takes me, I sort of do three edits. I sort of do an assemble edit. So I go through all the material and cut out all the mistakes and arrange the show into it's sort of like a running order. So then I know how long the show is going to last. So that's like the first assemble edit. And that can take me, depending on how complicated the show is, that can take me the best part of 3/4 of a day to a full day to do that. And then I go to have a second pass then through, and when I start looking at doing the transitions and titles, any special effects, you know, zooming into areas of the screen or doing anything like that. And that's probably another half a day. And then it's the whole post-production after that, which is the, you know, the encoding side of it, and then the creation of the different feeds. Because I run a paid membership scheme and also the free feed as well, there's at least 4 or 5 different RSS feeds that I have to manage and different versions of the shows.
Ouch.
Yeah, and I do different resolutions of the show, so I do high definition versions, iPod versions, sort of desktop versions as well, and, you know, some goes to paid content and some goes to free content. So it's quite a complex sort of post-production workflow, and, you know, that probably takes me another half a day. So, you know, you're talking a good 3 days work to actually get the half hour show, and that's, you know, 3 days solid, really.
And so screencasts online HD as well. So are you capturing video in HD, or is it just the screencast itself?
Well, I occasionally capture video, but it's really the HD is, I mean, I'm fortunate. I sort of cottoned onto the fact that HD was going to be big eventually, but this was like 2 years ago. So I started recording all my shows in HD resolution. So 1280 by 720. 2 years ago. So the 140 odd screencasts I've actually got, they're all in, well, except for about the first 20, they're all in HD resolution. They're all in 1280 by 720. So when someone joins the membership scheme, they actually get sort of that entire back catalogue of video tutorials in HD resolution.
A year ago, everybody was talking about the Apple TV is going to revolutionize podcasting. It's going to give us kind of a legitimate way into the living room. Do you see that happening yet for you, or is it still kind of a pie in the sky? It's just not there yet.
No, I think with the Take Two, it's made enormous strides. I think that's the game changer, really, the Apple TV Take Two. If they can get it into people's living rooms, you know, they're still not really marketing it. Well, from this side of the pond anyway, we can't really see much visibility of it. But, you know, once you've actually used it and you're cotton on to the fact that you don't have to subscribe to podcasts anymore, you can actually have podcasts on demand. And every Apple TV is connected to a HD TV as well. So, you know, you're going to get really good quality programs and good quality output from the Apple TV Take 2. I think it's going to be quite a major influence, really, on how independent media gets into the living room.
What's the software that you're using to edit? Are you using Final Cut Pro?
Yeah, Final Cut Pro. I've used various different software packages to actually do the video capture, so Snaps Pro X and iShowU. I'm currently looking at this ScreenFlow, which is the latest sort of...
Yeah, that's brand new.
Yeah, it came out a short while ago. And I currently use that just for the capture, if I'm honest, because... I've sort of got into a bit of there are certain things I do in my editing that give me a bit of speed, and some of the keystrokes and some of the facilities that I have in Final Cut Pro aren't quite there yet in ScreenFlow. So although I tend to capture in ScreenFlow, I still export from there and then do all my editing in Final Cut Pro. But I'm actually in touch with the developers of ScreenFlow. I'm sort of feeding in some ideas to them, which they seem quite...
Yeah, I saw that on your Twitter feed.
Yeah. Oh, I did a screencast for them today to show them one of the things I was talking about. So they were very appreciative of that. And they're actually said that one of the main things is the waveform. In Final Cut Pro, you can actually switch on, the audio track. I tend to use the audio track to guide me through where the good bits are and where the bad bits are, because where there's a bad bit, I don't speak, so there's you can actually see in the waveform where there's a bit that needs trimming out. And you can't actually do that with ScreenFlow because there's no waveform within the audio track. And that's quite a big thing for me. And when I demonstrated that today using a screencast, they I think the light bulb went on and they're trying to rush... Or they're looking very quickly at how
a new version.
Yeah.
1.5.
Yeah. 1.5, 0.1, 0.6.
No, but they've been very good, actually. They've been very responsive. I think they've had, since the first version 1 came out, I think they've had 3 betas. And also, I've got a big 30-inch monitor, so I've been helping them. They had a few issues with 30-inch displays, so they've resolved that now. So they've brought a couple of extra betas. I think they're up to 1.02 now, I think, which is the current release.
If anybody out there is interested in ScreenFlow, you could check them out at verasoftware.com. We actually have Paul Carnine coming on the 10th of April on the podcast to talk about ScreenFlow as well.
Oh, right. Okay.
Look at that. We've got him twice. It looks like an interesting program. What were you using before? What's kind of your workhorse? Is it a combination of tools, or is it like one major screen capturing application?
No, to be honest, most of the screen capturing applications do very much the same thing, i.e. they just capture the raw data from your screen, and then what you then do with it, people use other things. People use iMovie, people use Final Cut Pro, people use Final Cut Express. There's in the Mac environment, there's no ScreenFlow really is out on its own. It's the only one that I'm aware of anyway that has both the capture side plus the editing side built into a single package. Now, I know Camtasia do several Windows-based capturing tools, which also include the editing functions as well. And I think they're working on a Mac version, but that's not available yet. So there's only really ScreenFlow that does both gives you the capability of doing both the capture and the edit. But they've also, they've gone a step further as well. They've included some really cool new techniques that I've never seen before, and I think it's because of Leopard. They've got some really fancy elements in there that allow you to, put after the effect, or rather after you've captured the video, and you've just got this video captured in ScreenFlow, you can then go in and start sort of circling the mouse in retrospect. So, you don't have to do any effects while you're actually doing the recording. But during the editing process, you can switch on to have the mouse cursor highlighted and then switch it off again at various parts. Or you can get it...
Oh, that's awesome.
You can get it to zoom in to various areas of the screen really simply, whereas it takes me... I do that using keyframes and, it's quite complex in Final Cut Pro. This is literally, two mouse buttons.
Right on the fly.
Yeah. And they do other cool things as well, things I've never seen, which is if you have a window in focus, you can actually make that window bigger and then blur the background and fade it out as well. And it's all done sort of retrospectively. You don't have to do that while you're recording. There are some tools that will allow you to do that sort of on the fly as you're recording, but you really need 4 hands and 2 sets of eyes to do that, when you're trying to record and talk at the same time. So this takes a lot of the pressure off. You can do that in the post-production side of things.
So Screencast Online is not the only podcast you're involved with, correct?
That's right. Yes, that's right. Recently, in fact, just after Macworld, we've sort of resurrected the Mac Roundtable podcast.
Which I think is a great idea, by the way. I was really sad to see it go originally.
Yeah, well, it was really down to four guys, and I think they just had problems with it only being four people of getting the schedules together. So when we sort of met up at Macworld, we sort of said it wouldn't be a great idea to have, you know, the Mac Roundtable with just a bigger gang, a bigger crew, really. And
is that hard to manage?
It's still difficult, I must admit, because again, we've got four different time zones, because we've got people in Pacific, Central, and Eastern, and then me over in the UK. Actually, it's funny you should mention that. We've been doing it really strangely by just sending emails to each other, and we have like a shared web area, but it's still quite difficult to do. So I got a bit fed up this week and thought, right, I'm going to find out, there must be a better way to do this. So I've actually found, and this is the nice thing with Screencast Online, what I don't do is publish in advance a list of the topics that I'm going to cover. So I can keep that flexibility. So on Tuesday of this week, I did some research to find out if we could find a web service that would do all the scheduling for us. I found one, which is one of these Web 2.0 services. It's a service called Schedule Once. And I set it up to do the Mac Roundtable, and I thought, well, this is really great. This is a great service. I'm sure, you know, the viewers would like to see this. So I abandoned my plans for this week, and then, you know, Wednesday I actually did the show all about this new web service that I've just found the day before, and I'll be putting that out tomorrow. I'm just in the middle of doing the final edits on that.
I think you should hit them up for advertising.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's a free service as well, so, it's not a problem.
Yeah, how much are you going to get anyway? So, all right.
Really? You're going to get triple what you got the last time, which is zero.
Yeah.
So that must be quite, I mean, generating one every week, it must be quite difficult. Thinking, you know, what's the next one going to be about, and setting up a schedule of applications that presumably you have to spend enough time to learn to be able to create your show around that. So how do you manage that? And also, how do you decide which bits are going to be the free feed and which bits are going to be the paid for feed?
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. Most of the things that I do on the show are applications that I already am aware of. It's quite unusual for me to do an application that I'd only sort of seen a couple of days before, so this week's slightly unusual. Because, again, people tend to use the show now as a bit of a recommendation engine. I get lots of emails from people saying, look, they just don't have the time to spend time sort of searching out new applications. But they know that if it's on the show, that, you know, it reaches a certain level of usefulness, or it's a certain quality.
Right, well laid out.
Yeah. You know, so I don't really cover stuff that I wouldn't recommend to somebody, so they could use it as a recommendation engine. So I've got that, you know, it's always something that I'm familiar with already. But I can pick up things quite quickly if I have to. As far as which goes into the free feed and which goes into the paid-for feed, what I do now is it's every other week, basically. So 1 week it will be a members-only show, so they will get the full show. And then in the free feed, I'll put like a five-minute sort of shorter version, or even just a trailer to say what's in the member show that week. And then the following week, it's a full show for everybody. And then the next week it's back to a member show again. So it alternates between, you know. So if you sign up to the free feed, you know, you'll get get two free shows every month, of a full sort of video tutorial on various applications and web services.
How much does it cost if somebody wanted to
become
subscribe?
A member? What I've tried to do is keep the price sort of very, very low, so hopefully it's a bit of a no-brainer to people. When you first join, it's $45. For a 6 month membership, but that includes the next 6 months worth of shows. So you're looking at, you know, 26 half hour tutorials coming up in the next 6 months. But also that includes an element that gives you access to the back catalog. So, you know, on day one, you can actually go in and download 140 high definition video tutorials of everything from .Mac to iWork to iLife to all sorts of third party applications, Apple TV. You know, there's a whole host of tutorials already in the archive that members get access to immediately. And then after 6 months, after 6 months, if they still want to, there's no obligation to renew after 6 months. You know, you can just walk away at that point, and everything you've downloaded you can keep. There's no DRM on any of the shows. But if you want to renew, it's just $25 for every 6 months from that point on. Yeah.
That's great. Do you enjoy doing it?
Yeah,
I mean, that's
a
lot of people, you don't think about it. You thought, oh, someone must really enjoy doing that. But that's not always the case. So you love it.
Very much so. In fact, it's a bit weird in that I probably work twice as hard as I did now than I did in my corporate job. You know, I used to be an IT consultant, and you know, that was hard work. But you know, I think it's different when you're working for yourself and you're doing something that you enjoy. You don't mind putting the hours in, and also, you know, you get lots of feedback from people. It's a joy, really, if you know, if you hit the mark with a show and you get lots of feedback from people saying that, you know, it's really improved their work, or you know, it's something they'd never heard of before, and thank you so much for bringing it to their attention. And you know, it really does give you a buzz when you get that sort of feedback from people. So that's a reward in itself. Yeah.
Now, are there any companies that hire you explicitly to create tutorials for them?
I have done that in the past. I've done several sort of commissioned screencasts for people that didn't actually go on the show. The interesting thing is, I mean, I do a half-hour show every week, and that takes, you know, 3 days to put together. But if I do a five-minute video tutorial for a company, that can sometimes take me longer than 3 days, because it's a whole different ball game. It's normally scripted. It's normally very precise. It's normally, you know, they and some of the problems is people might put together, you know, think they know what they want, and you do it to their specification, but that when they see it, it's not really what they want, and you might have done it differently if it was down to me. So I tend not to do that as much now. What I'm trying to do now is to sort of focus more on the actual show itself. Right. Because obviously it's hard to do external work and the show itself. So this year I've sort of taken a decision. Yeah, well, also as well, I've been trying desperately to finish off a project I started last week, which is a thing called the Podcast Monetizer, which is really to give other podcasters the opportunity to benefit from the experience I've had over the past 2 years of turning my podcast from a hobby into a sort of a paying venture. So I've been trying to sort of put together some tutorials and sort of like an ebook and some information about, you know, what tools and what systems I use and how I've gone about setting everything up. But because I've been doing the commission stuff and because I've been doing the show every week, really, you know, there's been no free time to do that. So it was a definite decision this year to say, right, no more commissioned work, at least for the first part of the year. I'll concentrate on the show, and I'll also try and get this Podcast Monetizer project sort of out the door as well. So I know a lot of people are sort of looking forward to seeing that.
Very interesting, because, I mean, you often hear podcasters talk about monetizing, and you know, even the big podcasts like Twit seem to be struggling with the best way of doing that. So to see that you've actually managed to, you know, without any sort of sniff of venture capital funding or anything like that, just turn this into something that pays the bills is very impressive.
Yeah, I think the problem, and there's been quite a few blog posts floating around the past week or so from various people who are in this space, you know, looking at monetizing podcasts, that the thing that hasn't happened is advertising still hasn't come into podcasting in a big way. And I haven't sort of gone down that route. I've gone down the premium content route, you know, of actually still delivering free content, but, you know, delivering premium content as well, which people see value in and people don't mind paying for, because they know they're getting a good deal from it. So I've sort of not gone down the advertiser stroke sponsorship, although I do have the occasional sponsored episode from people, but it's mainly the premium content and the membership, you know, the subscription service that sort of pays the bills for me.
Yeah, Tim.
I was just going to ask Don, are you surprised that when I started in podcasting was about 2 months old at that point, and it was a very much a community effort. Everybody mm-hmm. helped everybody. That's not quite that way anymore, but it's kind of segmented. But I still see a lot of collaboration between competing podcasts, and I think that's great. Do you see that?
Oh, very much so, yeah, especially in the Mac community, you know, especially the Mac tech podcasts. I think there's the Mac Roundtable itself is a good example of that. You know, there's about 10 of us on there, and, you know, we all help each other out. We're all good friends with each other. We'll all look out for each other as well and do some cross-promotion as well if needs be. I'm a frequent attender to the Podcast Expo, or what used to be called the Podcast Expo it was in Ontario, it's now in Las Vegas this year.
And that's, the New Media Expo,
Expo, you're quite right. Yeah. And I sort of, this will be my third year of going, and I've noticed that, you know, over the past 2 years, that the first year when I went, I think the very first year when it started, it was very much a grassroots event, and there weren't really, you know, the business side of it wasn't really looked on. In fact, I think it was frowned upon at that time. It was very much a new grassroots movement. And then the second year when I went, there was an inkling of the business side of it, and some people were sort of starting to realize that, you know, it is actually, you know, it can be turned into a business. It doesn't necessarily have to be a business. It can still be a great hobby for someone or just an interest. You don't have to make money from it. But last year there was a definite buzz about, you know, well, this is the birth of a new industry, and the whole new media space was exploding, and people were a lot more serious about, you know, how to monetize it. Now this year, with it changing to the New Media Expo and with it being relocated to Las Vegas, I'm fully expecting it to be an even bigger event and to be quite serious on the monetization side. In fact, I've actually got a speaking gig there this year. I did one last year on screencasting, but this year I'm going to go over the transforming it from a hobby into a paying concern. So I'm really pleased to have been accepted as a speaker over there. So I'll be coming across to Las Vegas to relay my experiences in a session over there.
And how do you find doing, you know, that sort of speaking, public speaking, as opposed to the screencasts you do? Is there much? Yeah. You said you worked as an IT consultant, so did you do big presentations and keynote speeches in that job? And do you pick that up, or do you find that being a podcaster is a very good training ground for, you know, getting up in front of people and speaking live?
Yeah, I did do the occasional presentation, but not that much, to be honest. I think when you're podcasting, and you probably know yourselves, that when you're just speaking into a mic, you have no real perception of the number of people who would actually be listening to you at any one time.
That's what surprised me when you do actually get in front of
a group of people, it's still quite a nerve-wracking experience for me. I've done a couple locally. I mean, I do speak within the UK about podcasting, and so I've done a few of those over here as well. But it's still. In fact, I think I've got another one coming up at the end of this. In fact, no, a week on Tuesday, I'm over in. I think it's in Warrington. I'm speaking to an audience of business people about what podcasting and new media is all about.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I know last year I was asked by the Washington Apple Pie, which is the local users group, to do a presentation on podcasting back in March, and they haven't asked me to come back, so I'm not quite sure how that went.
So Don, I got an important question for you, and I usually ask all of our guests this. What was your first Mac?
Well, that's easy. As I said, I'm a fairly recent convert, so mine was the Mac Mini. That's
really?
When the first Mac Mini came out, that's when I made the switch.
I'd been
a PC user for the longest time. I mean, goodness, I remember DOS. So, I actually worked with PCs and Windows machines, and I just was so frustrated with the final straw for me was I worked for an IT company, and they had one of these special offers whereby you could buy their own branded kit, and I bought what I thought was my ultimate PC. It was the Christmas before the keynote when the Mac Mini was launched, and I actually got it for Christmas, and I was really pleased, and I set it up and put the antivirus on, and it just, you know, it was just the same as the PC I had before. It was really nothing special, you know, and I was so bitterly disappointed that it really didn't live up to what I thought it was going to do. And then I don't know how or why, because I'd never even considered Macs, because in the UK, especially, you know, 3 years ago, they really didn't have a presence here other than in, you know, design studios, or very few people were actually into Macs. And I just sort of came across the keynote, Steve Jobs' keynote, when he introduced the Mac Mini, and, you know, new things I hadn't heard of before. iLife, I think he demonstrated photo books on that one as well, and then he brought out the Mac Mini, and it was, you know, £300 or £400, and I thought, well, it's worth a punt. I'll just get one of those. I've got my keyboard, I've got my screen. Let's try it and see what it's all about. And that was it. I was hooked from that point on. So,
what were your first impressions of the Mac OS, and why did it help you?
It just made it enjoyable again. I'd sort of lost my enthusiasm for computing. I've always been a really, you know, big fan of IT and computing, and I've always liked being creative with it. I mean, I used to do some video editing on the PC for not anything big, but you know, I used to always just play around, and I really was enthusiastic about computing, and that seemed to wane. I sort of lost that, but when I got the Mac, it brought it all back again. It wasn't, you know, it took me a couple of days to get my head around some of the changes, but once I'd actually started using it, it sort of just felt right, and it just brought enjoyment back to it, to my hobby as it was.
Have you found that once you get into the Mac, especially as a recent switcher, and you meet other PC users, you try to convert them, or do you, that doesn't even enter into the problem anymore?
I don't bother. I really don't. If they don't get it, it's if they just don't get why they might want it. I'm finding more and more, though, people are warming to the fact. I mean, we were talking before we came on air that I had some air conditioning installed today in the studio I've got here. And, you know, one of the engineers who was installing the unit, he saw the Macs and went, "Oh, great, I'm getting a Mac." You know, just... So out came the card, check out the website. But, you know, more and more I'm finding people who previously I wouldn't have expected even to know about the Mac, they have an awareness about it now, and, you know, they're more open to considering it. I still think there's a problem over the pricing. Again, especially in the UK, they're still perceived as being a very expensive product. But you can't really explain to people, you know, it's if you do a like-for-like comparison with a highly spec Dell and an Apple, you know, in fact, in some cases, the Apple's going to be cheaper, because they just sometimes see, you know, PC World, $299 base units, and they think, that's a computer. How come this computer is so much more expensive?
Exactly.
So I've really stopped trying. I can sort of pick up pretty quickly if someone's going to be receptive to some of the ideas behind why they might want to go for an Apple. But if it's just the price equation, I just don't bother anymore. They'll get it eventually.
Did the community aspect of being a Mac user surprise you when you really got into it?
I think so, yeah, because I don't think there's an equivalent in the Windows world.
You don't hear about Dell, you know, user groups or anything like that.
No, and just the sheer amount of Mac podcasts and the amount of information there is to talk about around the Mac and Apple. There's thousands and thousands of PC applications, as many hundreds, if not thousands, of different types of PCs, you know, different manufacturers. But there's just no, that might be the problem. There might be too much, so there's no sort of central core of knowledge or central, you know, common experience that the PC users have that Mac users have.
So, Don, where can people go online to learn more about you and find screencasts online and all that good stuff and your other podcasts?
Sure, yeah. Well, if they just go to www.screencastsonline.com, they'll find the site there. And there's the links to the free feed. And if they go to screencastsonline.com/extra, that's where they can find out all about the membership scheme. But what I always say to people is sign up for the free feed, you know, have a look at the free show every other week. And then if you want to get access to the back catalogue, check out /extra, and you'll get all the information there. Mac Roundtable is macroundtable.com again. So, again, just subscribe to the iTunes feed there. We publish an audio podcast for Mac Roundtable every fortnight now, so there should be a new one coming out, I think, this Monday, which is one we recorded yesterday. So we're trying to keep that regular now, you know, every fortnight, because I think that's a secret as well with podcasts. You really need to have them regular and, you know, so people know when to expect them. So that's going to go out every other Monday for the Mac Roundtable. The Screencast Online shows go out every Friday, so there's normally something for people to watch over the weekend.
Okay, so a fortnight is...
His name is...
Two weeks. No, a fortnight.
Okay. Every 2 weeks.
I've made that mistake before, yeah. No, it's every 2 weeks is a fortnight, okay, that we say in the UK.
His name is Don McAllister. He's the host and producer of the Screencast Online. You can check him out at Screencast Online. .com or go up to mymac.com, look at show 176. We'll have a link directly to the site. Thank you very much for coming on the show this week, Don. We appreciate it. We've got David Cohen. Robert Hazelrig's got some commentary he wanted to share with the audience this week about AppleCare. So let's listen to that right now.
Hello, Robert Hazelrig here. Today I wanted to give you a quick commentary about AppleCare. I noticed recently, I've heard on a couple of other shows, some people having some bad experience with AppleCare, and I wanted to tell you about a recent experience of my own. just to preface this story briefly, I wanted to let you know one of the things that I do in my Princeton office is help administer the Macintoshes in my company. Now, I only have a handful or so of Macs to worry about in Princeton, but there are, oh, I want to say a dozen in East Rutherford and about 20 in New York City. For the most part, things are pretty smooth sailing with the Macs. It's, you know, you set them up and you run. But there is one Mac that had been giving me issues for several months, and I had tried to troubleshoot it using the, you know, the various rubber chicken techniques, you know, rebuild the preferences and zap the PRAM. I ran Disk Warrior. I even ran the hardware checker that is supplied by Apple. But the system, and the system in question is a dual processor, 2 gigahertz G5 with 2 gigabytes of RAM and I think a 160 gig hard drive. All the hardware tests and rubber chicken techniques didn't seem to come up with any issues. The hardware checker said there were no problems found. Disk Warrior found some minor things. But I couldn't find any solution to my problem. And just to back it up one more second, the problem was that the Mac seemed to have several kernel panics. I want to say when it first started out, it was about once a month. Then it got down to like once every other week, once every week, and then about twice a week it was kernel panicking. And it was kernel panicking at random intervals. Nothing seemed to coincide. Sometimes it would kernel panic when the screensaver's on, sometimes when you're running PowerPoint, sometimes when you're surfing the web. It didn't seem to be anything that I could replicate. Obviously, the first thing I did check was the RAM, but that came up with a positive test also, or a negative test. It came up clean either way. But anyway, approximately 4 weeks ago, I called AppleCare and told them of my problem. We went through the various techniques that they had asked me to try, and I told them that I had tried most of them already, but went through the steps anyway to please them. And they told me, yes, sure enough, I need to bring it into the Genius Bar. And I did. I brought it to the Short Hills Mall location. Upon where which they told me that they were going to need to confiscate my machine for an extended period of time. And yes, even though this was a production machine, I had backed everything up properly and luckily had a backup system for someone to work on. After some periodical checking in on my behalf to see how they were making out with the machine, I finally got a call back approximately 3 weeks later, and they told me they were unable to discern what was the problem and that they would be replacing my machine. At first, I was a bit shocked, and then I got really excited because they told me they would be replacing it with an 8-core Intel Mac. Much to my delight, the machine is incredibly fast and a huge step up from my dual 2 gigahertz G5. And now I've actually found myself wishing that all my other Macs would fall apart or explode before my AppleCare runs out so I can get them replaced by brand new 8-core Mac Pros. There is one downside to the story, though. The Mac Pro that replaced the G5 is not the machine that I use in this office. Or at least it won't be for the near foreseeable future. And the reason being is there is an individual in my office that runs Windows quite frequently. And she actually has two computers on her desk, as do I. But she uses Windows much more frequently than I do because she does so much PowerPoint work. So to free up her PC for another user, I actually got her a copy of VMware's Fusion. We've only been using it for about 4 days now, but so far so good. I'm extremely impressed. The speed in its ability to switch from Mac to Windows is incredible. The system prior to this, the way it was set up, she used a KVM switch to switch back and forth between her Mac and her PC. And I want to tell you, VMware is even faster than the KVM switch in switching back and forth, which is extremely nice. So I am fairly certain that moving forward, all of the dual system setups, in other words, all of the users in my company that use Macs and PCs, will be replaced by a single Mac that will be running VM Fusion and Windows on it just for that flexibility, speed, and ease of use. Anyway, to wrap it up, I believe that AppleCare is money well spent, and I feel bad for those individuals who've had some bad luck with it recently. Thanks for listening. This has been Robert Haslerick.
And thanks for sending in the feedback, Robert. I had a brain melt right there for a second. Anybody else that wants to send feedback to the show, you know, we will play it right online, so we're going to share your opinions with everybody that listens. All you have to do is call a telephone number from any landline. Hey, Guy, give them the number. Do you know it?
That number is 1-801-938-5559. And you can also contact us via our email address, which is mymacpodcast@gmail.com.
Audible.com is our sponsor for this week. They bought two ads from us last week and this week. And I think I might run it one extra week because last week's show was kind of a train wreck. Kind of had a train wreck last week.
But as compared to...
Yeah, I tell you. But so let's do a little bit of an ad for Audible.com and go up to MyMac.com and click the link that says AudiblePodcast.com/MyMac. That way we get kind of credit for that. But yep. I do got one book this week that... I was really impressed with. I haven't gotten all the way through it yet, but it's John Adams. Now, I had no idea that John Adams was such a pivotal figure in early American history. And it's just amazing everything that this guy, he pretty much wrote the Constitution. I mean, he's the one that pretty much called for the American Revolution. I mean, John Adams was, and I know we're talking to someone from Britain.
I was going to say, David Cohen is currently being very, very quiet.
that's ancient history at this point. But the guy's life was just amazing. His fish-out-of-water experiences in France at the time is really fun to listen to. This guy's a farmer. That's what he was. And then he became a lawyer. And he was actually the lawyer who got the British soldiers off for what's now called the Boston Massacre. He got them off. And I had no idea that he was a lawyer who did that. It's an amazing story. And anybody that wants to listen to that book, go up to audiblepodcast.com/MyMac, and you can get it for free. All you got to do is sign up for a free account. You guys ever use Audible?
Yeah, I look at it all the time. I mean, the problem I have is that finding time to read or listen to books is always a problem for me. But the fact that you can download a whole book and listen to it in the car or something like that is really very cool. I mean, I have a recommendation actually. If you're interested in British radio humour, I mean, because we have the BBC. There is some really, really fine British comedy. You know, all the stuff that you American guys will have heard of, like the Goon Show and the Monty Python people. They all started in radio before they got into TV, and you can get some great stuff on Audible that's been published by the BBC, and it's been taken from radio series. One that I'd recommend to you is two guys called Mitchell and Webb. Mm. There's a program called That Mitchell and Webb Sound. Now, Mitchell and Webb are the guys who played the PC and the Mac
and
the
PC.
Yeah, in the British version.
I actually blogged about that. And talked about it on the show once or twice that I thought they made a much better, at least the Mac guy was a much better Mac guy than what we have here in the States.
Well, yeah, and also the guy plays the PC. He's got that real uptight, very prissy, everything's got to be just so approach.
I never kid about the naughty step.
Exactly, yeah. So they did a show called That Mitchell and Webb Sound, which is like a sketch show, and you can get that on Audible. It's been taken from the BBC, and really is fantastic. Very, very funny, and if you like, off-the-wall British comedy, you can't go wrong with those two guys. And again, you can get it free with the sign-up code.
And who doesn't like off-the-wall, offbeat British comedy? I mean, it's. I think it's brilliant. I mean, I really do. I love it. It seems to me that some of the British comics have a lot more of a Oh, what's the word I'm looking for? They're willing to take chance. Well, they're not at all.
That wasn't where we were going with that.
They seem to want to take more chances than their American counterparts for the most part. A lot of American comedians tend to go for the shock value, profanity, and it's not very clever most of the time. Whereas British humor tends to be much more clever, and I appreciate that. I wish more American comics would do that. The writing is better.
It's a drier humor that you actually, you know, that you kind of have to pay attention.
The thing is a lot of the British stuff is written by a single person or a group of people for an entire series, whereas a lot of American comedies tend to take the team of writers approach, and those are fine if you want a series of very funny, well crafted jokes because you've got a whole team. Tossing the gags out there, but really, if you want something that's got a bit more narrative and a bit more of a flow to it, and then something that's been written by a pair of guys who then go and actually do it is really quite good.
Yeah, I really one of my favorite actors is up on Audible as well, and that's Ricky Gervais. Is that how you say his name, Gervais?
Ricky Gervais.
I want to say Gervais. I don't know why.
Yeah.
He is just brilliant. They've got the complete third season, the complete first season, up on Audible as well. And those are funny shows to listen to.
Now, he's very interesting.
It's a podcast.
Yeah, it was a podcast. And going back to the conversation we had with Don, you know, they experimented. They did the first season of that for free, and then the second season you had to pay for.
I paid for the second season because I enjoyed the first season so much. It was so great.
Again, they're real talent, and this is what he did with The Office as well, is to make something that looks like it's just happening spontaneously, and yet it's hilariously funny because it actually is very, very well-crafted comedy. And now, I think that podcast is a perfect example of that.
Yeah, exactly. Have you ever watched his series Extras?
Yes.
I think Extras is the best thing he's ever done. I really like the British The Office. I like it a lot better than... Well, I used to like it a lot better than the American version, but I think the American version's come a long way.
Yeah.
It's kind of has its own identity at this point. But
that's right.
Extras, it was two seasons and then one, like, 90-minute finale movie.
Exactly.
And it was just brilliant. It was cringe-inducing laughter. You would watch him go, oh, I can't believe so-and-so did that. Or the guy's on a date and he uses the bathroom and comes back and grabs... like a knife or something, and goes back into the bathroom because everything didn't flush right the first time.
That's right, yeah.
And then he flushes, and then he's kind of standing there at the door waiting to see if it flushed at all, and he's kind of, it's this awkwardness, and you're just like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that. And it's so funny.
The clever thing about Extras is, it started as literally that, you know, he was an extra, he was always an extra in a movie and he never had any success. And then as the series progressed and nobody was really expecting this, it turned into this thing where he had a sitcom, the character he was playing had a sitcom that he'd written and he became a star, and it got turned into something that he wasn't remotely happy with. And yet he couldn't push himself away from the fame, even though he hated himself for doing it, because it was, you know, it was the tackiest British sitcom he'd ever been in, and it was his creation. And of course, all of that really mirrors his experiences of being thrust into the spotlight, you know, with The Office, and all of a sudden people are looking up to him as somebody who he's not. They're looking up to him as the character he played and not as the person he actually is. Exactly.
Now, you know, I know we're way off topic, and we are still talking about Audible, because you can get all his stuff up at audible.com. You know, he has a new movie coming out called This Side of the Truth, and it's the concept of this movie... sounds so funny to me. And he's actually posting video stuff from the movie, not of the movie, but, you know, as they're in production and stuff.
Yeah.
Up on his website, RickyGervais.com, This Side of the Truth. And basically, he's in a world where no one has ever lied. It's a foreign concept. Everyone always tells the truth, and he is the only person in this world who can actually lie.
Oh my God.
Nobody in this world has ever heard of a lie before, anything he says, they completely believe him, because lying is a totally different... that's such a perfect role for him. Yeah. It really is. I'm looking forward to that. So, have you ever used Audible? Guy?
Yes, I have. As a matter of fact, I recently downloaded, and you know, we've gone from American history to British humor to, you know, I mean, as typical, I'm the odd guy out. Star Trek. it was actually done a couple of years ago with Leonard Nimoy, who of course played Spock, and John DeLancey, who played Q in The Next Generation. It's called Spock versus Q.
Now, I met John DeLancey at Macworld Expo in 2000.
Yeah, he's supposed to be a really, really nice guy.
Yeah, he's a big Mac guy, too. And he's really, really tall. He's like 6'5". That's short next to you.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm sorry, how does that make him tall again?
He is tall next to me.
But they did this thing. It was called Alien Voices, and this was Spock versus Q. They did this in front of a live audience. Leonard Nimoy is playing Spock. John DeLancey is playing Q. And it's Spock comes back in time to warn 20th century Earth that there's this big disaster going to happen. And he's not quite saying what it's going to be. And Q is interrupting him. And he ends up tricking Q into explaining what was going on and trying to get Q to stop this big disaster from happening. And it probably doesn't sound as interesting as it really was, but it's just that the interplay between these two actors is just so spot on. It's a joy to listen to.
Now, I've not heard of this. I love spin-off Star Trek books. I mean, when I was growing up, that was all I ever used to read.
Right.
You know, whenever I used to go out to the States, I used to go out quite a lot on holiday, that sort of thing, I always used to take the opportunity to go to a bookstore and buy a few of them, because I really just enjoy, I love Star Trek and really enjoy reading them. I've not heard of this, but I think this is a fantastic idea, because Q is very, you know, he's very mischievous Exactly, and Spock is obviously extremely logical, and you know that I can imagine the two of them bouncing off each other must be something.
Well, they actually did two of these. The first one, as I said, was done in front of a live audience, so it's only 54 minutes long. So it's not a real long one to listen to. As a matter of fact, this podcast will probably end up being longer than what this first one was. They did a sequel to it that I haven't listened to it in a very, very long time, but I don't believe they did that one live. But it's the same kind of concept. It's Spock and Q, and there's something going on, and you know, they have to work together to work it out. And on both of them, I really, really enjoyed the first one, which is the live one. And I enjoyed the second one, though, for different reasons.
Yeah.
Hmm. Let's thank Audible.com for sponsoring this week's podcast.
Thank you, Audible.
AudiblePodcast.com/MyMac. Anybody listening, please go up there and sign up for a free account. Maybe they'll continue to advertise on the show, and I'll be able to pay for our server space, because we've got a lot of stuff going on up on the MyMac server right now. I just redesigned the entire top of the website. What do you guys think?
I like it. It looks nice and clear, and you know, bit fresh and more modern, and pretty good.
Yeah, I looked at it at work today on a PC using they're using IE6, and where the MyMac logo is, it had some problems. But other than but it's IE6, so it's got that's got its own problems.
It's not complete. I still have a lot more work to do. Some of the design at the top is a carryover from the old design, including the navigation where it says Home Archives.
Right.
That's still the old one, but I'll get to it eventually. I'm not too concerned. But what I really wanted to do was get the MyMac magazine logo back and the new character logo.
Yeah.
Those are the two things that I wanted to get up on the site, because that's the logo that we're using for this podcast. It's on our business cards. If you know how on the new iPhone that you can actually put a bookmark for a website right on the main screen now?
Yes.
If you do that with the MyMac.com, you see that logo, just the little character. So I wanted to make the site look like all the other graphics, so that was kind of important to do. So that's done now, thank goodness. Up on the site, we'll get to the news and some other stuff real quick, but let's focus on what's going on at MyMac.com since the last show that we did. I'm not even sure how it's Saber Femme and Home iPod speaker from John Nemirovsky. Did you guys see that iPod speaker? So
yeah, it looks kind of cool. I don't think I would like it so much in pink.
No.
I don't think the pink color would do it for
$60. I mean, it looks like it's got some pretty hefty cones on it. So, you know, for $60, maybe it would be pretty good sounding. I think John gave it a pretty decent review.
You know, the funny thing is, I'm pretty on top of getting stuff posted up at mymac.com, because anything that's on the feature side obviously goes through editing, which is me. And, you know, it could take me a little bit of time. The thing is, I got a review called of a book called The Apple Training Series iWork 08 from David Graham that I posted up a couple days ago up on mymac.com. I actually got that review before Macworld Expo. I got it before Christmas. That's right. In the middle of December, I got this review. And somehow it slipped through the cracks and I never saw it. I was doing a search for something else, came across it in my email. There it was. I checked the site. It was never posted. So a public apology right here to David Graham, one of our writers, for never posting this review until now. I didn't hold it up because it wasn't any good or anything like that. I lost it. So apologies. I throw myself on my sword.
Well, wait till after the podcast.
That's right. David Weeks did a review of another Take Control series of the books. Now it's a Take Control of Permissions in Leopard. Do you guys have any problems with Leopard and permissions?
No.
I haven't really had too many problems.
You know, I mentioned before that I've just done a hard drive upgrade on my MacBook Pro, and I'm having all sorts of permissions problems now. I use Super Duper, but I'm having a lot of weirdness since I've moved to the new drive. So I think something's gone wrong with the accounts or something else I've moved over, and I've tried to fix it. I've you know, reset permissions and change some accounts and that sort of thing. But I'm actually getting to the point. I'm thinking it might just be easier just to wipe the thing and you know.
Is it Apple apps or is it third party?
A little bit of both. Mail keeps crashing and in Leopard, and you know it will just literally just die and then come back.
How did you bring the information over from the old one?
I basically, what I did is I super dupered the drive to an external USB, and then I replaced the drive, which was failing in the MacBook Pro, with a newer, larger drive, and then I used super duper to clone the thing back again.
So it should be exactly the same.
In fact, even when I did that, when I first tried to do the super duper clone back, super duper said, I'm having problems with permissions. I've not got rights to write to the drive.
Did you format the drive before you tried to move the stuff over?
I did, yeah. Maybe I shouldn't have done that.
Well, no. Actually, you should have done that.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So anyway, I don't know. It's a bit strange, but I mean, I take the view with these things that I'll sort of try and figure it out. If I'm not getting very far with it, it's probably quicker just to format and reinstall Leopard from scratch, and then just reinstall my apps and move my data over and do it like that.
You know, that is kind of a pain in the butt, and it takes longer, but in some respects, I think that's almost better, because you know for a fact it's all nice and squeaky.
Exactly. I don't want to be 3 months down the line, be, you know, all of a sudden start having problems and then start thinking, oh, maybe I should have.
Exactly.
You know. So I think I'll do that.
The iMac upstairs, the iMac upstairs was the first machine that I pretty much started from factory settings. Up to that point, I had been migrating from macOS 10.0 up until the end of Tiger. It was basically the same machine that I was bringing with me, you know,
from
G4 to the G5 to the...
FireWire shuffle.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's really... Then again, it was always stable, so I can't really complain. Rich Lefko did a review of an iPod. It's called the Thumps from... Audio Wraps from iFrog. You know, the thing is, he gives it a 3.5 out of 5, but yet somehow this won a best of show at Macworld 08.
Well, you know, I had spent some time there at the iFrogs booth, and they had that product, and they had the, I can't remember what it was called now. It was just this little tiny speaker that it plugged into the audio port.
Yeah.
But it really had some amazing sound to it. And when I looked at the audio wraps, I was kind of like, you know, it's okay. Yeah. I didn't really care for the sound out of it. But I really like that little speaker whose name escapes me.
Newer technology, Mini-Stack NAS, Network Attached Storage Review from Larry Grinnell. You know that guy.
Yeah, I think I grew up with him.
And I did a kind of a long article called The Impact of iPhone on Gaming. I don't know if you guys had a chance to read that long article yet.
No, I haven't had a chance to read that.
No, I haven't seen it either.
Okay, don't bother. It's
okay.
So what's going on in the Mac world right now? I know that, Roger Bourne and the MyMac.com staff on the emailing list sent out a notification saying, what's everyone think about, you know, the subscription service on iTunes like it was a done deal.
Well, yeah. All I know is that, you know, they're in talks, as I understand it, they're in talks with the Universal Music Group to do some kind of subscription plan. But honestly, it doesn't sound like something Apple would do. But, you know, I mean, Apple being a hardware company, you know, they throw the content out because that's what drives people to buy the hardware. And
But isn't at this point though the iPod is kind of how many more iPods can they reasonably be expected to sell? I mean, everybody.
Well,
has
let
an
me
iPod.
Ask you this:
what are they going to do to get people to buy a brand new?
How
iPod?
Much longer do you? How much longer do you think iPods in their current form are going to be around? I think maybe.
Not
I
much
think
longer.
They're getting ready to try to get people to move to the iPhone iPod Touch form factor.
I think so too. What do you think, David?
I think I'd agree with that. I think if they want people to buy more iPods, they'll change the iPod. I don't think they will, you know, mess around too much with the content model. I mean, the thing is with the subscription thing is that people say this is what everybody wants, everyone's really interested in, but plenty of companies have tried to do subscriptions and have failed.
Right.
Whereas iTunes is...
But nobody's had the market penetration that Apple has had with the iPod. I mean, I just look at my daughters, my 13-year-old kids, and they're so into their iPods right now, and yet if they want to buy something, they literally have to come and ask me. Can I buy, you know, a song? Yeah, go ahead. If there was a subscription service that I could spend a very small amount of money for, or if it was free, it's just kind of rolled into the price of the device, and it's all you can eat, I would be all over that for them.
But you know what will happen? And I've no idea whether it's true that Apple are talking to the music industry about this, but what will happen if the music industry say, yeah, okay, we'll do that, and they fix up a price, I guarantee you within 18 months of them launching the product, there will be some new album that comes out, and the music industry will go, oh, this one's special. This one's not part of the subscription deal. This one's you got to pay a little extra. So,
it won't be on for like 2 months or something like that after.
It'll be a Walmart exclusive.
Well, I mean, they're already doing this with video.
And they're already doing it on the Zoom marketplace. That was one of the things with the Zoom. When the Zoom came out, they said, oh, we've got a subscription model. And I know my brother has a Zoom, and he's looked at some of the... He says some tracks you go to get them, and it says, oh, no, sorry, you've got to pay for these. They're not part of the subscription deal.
Then it's not all you can eat.
No, it's all you can eat as long as they want to feed it to you.
Well, they're feeding us something.
Mm. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think this is kind of a wait and see if it happens, and Apple kind of corrects those problems. I think I would be interested. I think a lot of people would be, but if it kind of goes the way that you predict there, David, I don't know if I'd be so interested at all.
Yeah.
I mean, if the big hot song right now, I have to spend an extra $99 on top of a subscription service, well, I don't know how valuable the subscription service would be at that point. So Airport Extreme was updated. It looks like you can now use an external USB drive on your Airport Extreme. This isn't the new Airport Extreme. This is the older ones.
Yeah.
You can plug
at least I'm hoping it's all of them. I mean, I just updated because I've got the first gen 802.11n Airport Extreme and haven't hooked up a drive to it. I've got a Time Machine drive that's directly connected to my iMac here. And I think probably sometime this weekend I'm going to go ahead and connect up the my Time Machine drive to it, and we'll see how it works out.
It's not just the USB thing that they fixed. They fixed a ton of bugs in those. I've found with mine that now if I make a change to the configuration, it reboots straight away, and the signal comes straight back, you know, within 5-10 seconds. Whereas before it would be about 2.5 minutes before the thing was ready to reconnect me to the internet. And I've also found that I was having before this update, there were some problems if you were trying to connect to a corporate VPN and then pass traffic over that, say, to a mail server. You could only do that with one machine. You had to turn on a special network address translation mode to make that work properly with the Airport Extremes, and they fixed that now, so I can connect from any machine on my network.
Nice.
So, they've obviously done a real number on the firmware on all of those routers and sorted them out.
Awesome. I have to check it out. I don't know if there's been so many updates the last couple weeks from Apple that I can't remember what I have updated and what I haven't at this point. One of the things that I do have on that iMac, and this was what I was alluding to earlier, Guy, right before we started doing this podcast, and we were actually running way over as far as how late we usually record, so my wife's going to be getting upset, and I have to wrap this up here pretty quickly. Yeah. But let me get
I don't know anything about that.
The iMac crashed on me right before I was going to start recording this podcast, and I found that out because I was trying to share the screen on the iMac upstairs from this machine, which is a MacBook Pro, and I didn't see it. So I went up there, and sure enough, it was locked up. I restarted it, and it restarted in Windows Vista. I thought, what the heck? So I restarted it again, and it went to Vista. So I started again the third time, held down the Option key. Didn't give me any option at all. It just booted right to Windows again. Very, very odd. Right now, it's probably done at this point, but I put the Leopard install disk in. It saw the Mac partition just fine. It said there was no problems with it when I did repair disk, so now it's repairing permissions. And when I walked by it to come down to record the podcast, there was probably 1,000 different permissions that it was fixing. So something is very sick with my Mac. But the funny thing is, it was booting fine into Windows, and that's all it was booting into. It wasn't booting into the Mac. It's like, oh, great, now I have an iMac Windows-only machine. Gee, thanks, Apple.
Isn't that what everyone wants?
This is handy. Oh, man, I couldn't believe it. But, yeah, it's crazy. Also, next week, I think Lee will be back with us, Lee Gibbons. He was on the road this week, couldn't make it on the show. Yeah. You know how those Wi-Fi is in the hotels. Yeah. He didn't want to take a chance. And so, obviously, we missed him this week. We look forward to talking to him next week. Anything coming up on the horizon that we should be talking about, David?
No, you caught me on the hop there.
I'm not going to ask Guy because now he's prepared. I will be talking about the new time capsule device from Apple. I've got that on order. Hasn't showed up yet. I also got, and it arrived today, an Apple TV.
Nice.
And I got the 160 gig. And I tried to sync it, but it was going so slow over my Airport Extreme that I quit it.
Did you update it?
I haven't. Well, this isn't the end network.
Oh, you've got the spaceship.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. So it was just so slow, I decided not to even bother. I'm just going to wait till the time capsule gets here. I got the 1 terabyte time capsule coming. For the price, it's worth getting the extra 500 gigs.
Yeah, well, and plus also, it's really easy to sync up multiple machines with time capsule.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that, you know, with the laptop, with the MacBook Pro, it's not being backed up at all. Now, obviously, I don't keep a whole lot of stuff on here, but there is an occasion that I'll download something like this podcast that's on this machine that's not on the other machine yet. So, anyways, we should probably wrap up this show. It's getting a little bit long in the tooth. We're about at an hour and 7 minutes. So, thanks very much to Don McAllister for coming on. He's a heck of a nice guy.
Nice, yeah.
We have to have him. You know, quite honestly, I wasn't as prepared for this show as I would have been otherwise because of all the problems that I had with my computers right at the last second. I had to go to Chad Perry's house while I was supposed to be recording this podcast to get my old recording gear because the new stuff simply wasn't working. So thanks very much to Chad Perry for wrapping all this stuff up and handing it to me out the door when I pulled up to his house. He saved the show. I think we're going to have Chad Perry back on the show real soon to get it caught up because he got a iPod Touch. And I want to sit down with Chad on the podcast and talk about the Touch a little bit. Remember, he talked about getting a Touch for almost a whole year
Rich Lefko, he's actually gone out and bought one.
Yes, unlike Rush Lefko.
Yeah, Rich always seems to find a reason. That's great, but it doesn't have this.
Yeah, basically, Rich had been saying for a long time he was waiting for a 32 gig, and when that came out, he then said he wanted a 7-inch screen. And at that point, I said, actually, Rich, what you're saying is you don't really want one of these at all.
He doesn't want one. He wants a new MacBook. Yeah. That's what
he wants an EPC.
That's right. So thanks for coming on, guys. I know it's getting late for you, David. We do appreciate you being on the show this week. And Guy, as always, thank you for being on.
That's great. I love doing it.
Always a pleasure.
It's fun. Looks like we may be going up to the Apple Store again in Grand Rapids, Michigan. They keep asking us to come back up, and my willpower is getting weak, so I might go up there and do another show here within the next
three months. Well, we got the 200th episode coming up pretty soon.
That is true. Maybe. That is true. This is show 176, so I'd have to pull out a calendar and look to see exactly when it is. Next week, Guy, you're going to appreciate this. We've got a special guest next week, Dave Hamilton.
Oh, great.
You know who
he
is.
Yeah, I think I've met him once or twice.
You met him once or twice.
Four or five.
David Hamilton, obviously, is from the Mac Observer. He's one of the founders
over there.
Great
podcast, too. Yes,
and they have a great podcast. And I'm looking forward to chatting with him on the podcast. We've never had him. I don't think we've had anybody on this podcast from the Mac Observer. Not that I could think of. We had John Martellaro, but he's kind of with MyMac and the Mac Observer.
Oh,
so I don't
we had Chris for a long time, too. Chris Siebel.
Well, he's never been with the Mac Observer.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were... Okay, never mind.
No, he was with Apple Matters.
Well, still is.
Yep. Still is. Yeah, he does the history piece over there. He's been doing it for a couple of years. It's amazing that Apple has that much history that he could spend a couple of years writing about Apple history once a week. That's amazing. So anyways, we're out of here. We'll be back same time, same place, same channel next week.
Thanks for downloading the MyMac.com podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our RSS feed at MyMac.com or by visiting the iTunes Music Store's podcast section. Please send all feedback to MyMacPodcast@gmail.com. And thanks for listening to the MyMac.com podcast.